You ever see this guy with the pillows on Fox? My pillow guy, Mike Lindell. He is the greatest. The My Pillow guy. Mike Lindell. And he's been with us right from the beginning.
Mary gets married to a gentleman named Evans and must let the election board know. The election board inactivates her Mary Johnson voter record and creates a new one under the name Mary Evans. At election time, her old Mary Johnson record can be silently reactivated and used to vote however the perpetrator wants. After the election, the Mary Johnson record can be returned to inactive status. There is no existing safeguards against this type of election fraud, nor are there in processes for the elections office to detect it after it happens. Voters who move within their county are also handled the same way.
If you're going to have a fake ballot, you're going to need a person in the voter rolls to assign that ballot to. And it goes a little something like this, from what I have seen in my observations. First thing they go for is any voter that was created completely fictitiously. They have been entered into the rolls. So we have third-party companies like Eric who have access or at least influence into who gets added to our voter rolls. I think that is a stone-cold fact. So the ability is there to get people who aren't real people or people who are real but are very unlikely to register. In Arkansas, for instance, before the last election, they had a tremendous number of people over 90 suddenly decide to register to vote. That is not normal. That doesn't usually happen. And that could very well be an example of what I'm talking about. So you use that pool of people who are either fake or aren't really registered. They don't know they're registered. Because those are the safest ones to use to assign fake votes to. When they run out of those, the next thing to go to are the inactive voters, the records of those. Switch them to active, and then they can vote and be switched back to inactive. So that's your second pool. Then if they run out of those, then they have to start using low probability voters. These are people that are calculated to be very unlikely to vote in the election. If somebody hasn't voted in an election in a long time, which is another problem with the voter rolls, by the way, in that we're not enforcing the age out of them. In other words, if you haven't voted in so many elections, you get purged. That in a lot of cases isn't happening. And even if it is happening, as I said before, they're keeping the inactive records in there. So they are still useful. But nevertheless, they can figure out based on age, demographics, a lot of things, who is unlikely to vote or likely to vote in any given election. So they will use that pool. Then they run into a danger area, though, because if they guess wrong and they use an existing person to cast a early or absentee vote, if that person then wanders into the election office on election day and tries to vote, they're going to hear, well, I'm sorry, sir, you've already voted. If that sounds familiar, it's because it happens all the time. You hear the stories, they never go anywhere, but people show up and they're told they already voted. I believe that most of those are voters who the algorithm, the people who decide, they did not expect them to vote. And they did. They did not expect them to vote, and they did. Now, if they run out of voters from the voter rolls that they can use for fake votes, a lot of us refer to that as running out of runway. That's where they have a problem, and that's where they have to panic. And incidentally, that's what happened in places like Florida in the 2020 election, according to the data that I have seen.
Examination of our voter rolls led Jeff down an unexpected path, as he discovered a system known as the Help America Vote Verification System, or HAVV. The Help America Vote Act created a system whereby citizens wishing to register to vote without state-issued identification could have their identity verified by the Social Security Administration. Election officials can send the person's name, birthdate, and the last four digits of their Social Security number to the online HAVV system and quickly be informed if that information matched an American citizen. Looking at the purpose of the system as defined on the Social Security HAVV website confirms that the system is designed for use in the rare case where a citizen does not have state-issued identification. However, when Jeff downloaded the lookup statistics from the HAVV site, he noted that there were many more lookups than he expected, and that on average 1/4 of them are rejected as not matching a citizen.
I don't think you can escape the conclusion here that the HAVV lookup system is being used to game our voter rolls, to game our registration systems. If they're not being used to game our registration systems, they're certainly being used for another improper purpose. And there needs to be investigation by those who can compel answers from the Social Security Administration and from the states and counties that are using the HAVV system. What you are seeing here is the calendar year 2020 HAVV lookups from the top 10 states. You'll see as the numbers pile up through the year and they accelerate as we get closer to the November election. Yes, you are seeing millions and hundreds of thousands in all of these states. And remember, on average, 1/4 of them do not return a match. Now, I just told a little white lie. These are not the top 10 states. Watch what happens when we add Texas to the mix. That's right, over 6 million HAVV lookups in 2020. Are we really supposed to believe that so many people across this country show up to register to vote without a valid ID? And then we also supposed to believe that 1/4 of them across the country do not know their name, their birth date, and the last four of their Social Security number? If you believe that, I don't know what to tell you.
Attempts to find information about the use and policies of the HAVV system by election officials through public records requests have been non-responsive or unhelpful.
The number of ballots referenced in the adjudication database was not the same as the number that was in the main database.
At this point, Mr. Struwe got very upset with me and threatened legal action, including an FBI raid.
How did we get here?
The 2020 election was perhaps the most contentious election in American history. Those who went to bed on election night with President Donald Trump seemingly headed to a sure Electoral College victory awoke to a nightmare. During the night, counties in numerous battleground states had stopped counting, and when they resumed, Democrat Joe Biden's numbers kept going up in all of them. Over the next several days, states kept counting absentee votes until finally, Joe Biden was declared the winner by the news media. Despite the best efforts of Donald Trump supporters to delay certification until the growing amount of evidence could be fully investigated, Congress made the election official on January 6, 2021. After over 3 years of research, this is the story of the major ways the election was stolen and how we can prevent this from ever happening again. These are the fingerprints of fraud. Have you ever wondered how the vote counts get to the television coverage on election night? Edison Research is a New Jersey company that over the last decade has established a monopoly on election night reporting to national news outlets. All vote updates from all counties throughout the course of vote counting eventually make their way to Edison, although the path of those updates is not consistent or easily understood. In the 2020 election, The New York Times made the state and county vote updates from Edison Research available via their website. The numbers, which were recorded in real time, show a surprising number of anomalies, including vote counts going down when they should only go up and vote counts being switched back and forth between absentee and in person.
At issue here is that when you're counting votes, like whether you're counting votes or counting coins or counting grains of sand, I like to go up. And when you're counting something and those numbers go down, that indicates that there is a problem. Either a mistake was made or something else is going on. There are three types of votes reported in the Edison reporting. There are the total votes, and then those are broken out into votes for each of the major candidates. Then a lot of the states will also include breakouts for the in-person votes and the absentee votes. Now, those breakouts are only in the county level file, not in the state level file. None of those numbers should ever go down. Now, mistakes are made. We are human. And as you just saw, the route that these numbers go from the county to Edison and the news media is a bit circuitous and puzzling at times. However, if you have more than a couple instances of these numbers going down, that would indicate that you have either someone who really doesn't know how to type doing the typing, and I really don't think that's the case, or you have something else at play.
Jeff created some informative videos to try to spread word of the significance of the numbers changing in the wrong directions. According to the data reported by Edison Research and the New York Times website, the following is a reenactment of the total vote count during 2020 election in Philadelphia County, Pennsylvania, a process that took 22 days.
We've talked a lot about algorithms in the last few chapters. I believe we have another one here that is showing up in the Edison results. In the video you just saw, you saw the absentee and the in-person votes, in some cases, apparently swapping back and forth. This looks very much to me like an algorithm, some sort of a software controller that is trying to solve a problem and having trouble doing it. So it keeps trying different solutions. Let's get this out of the way right now. Anytime you bring up the Edison election night reporting numbers with an election official, the immediate reaction is, it doesn't matter, they're unofficial numbers. Well, here's the problem I have with that. First of all, they do end up, in almost every case, at the same numbers reported by the county and by the state. I find that interesting for unofficial numbers. Secondly, races are called on these reported numbers. Also, think about this. These numbers that are released in the evening on the East Coast are, in a lot of cases, seen by people on the West Coast and in the central part of our country who, in some cases, haven't voted yet.
Jeff did a deep dive into the millions of data points produced by Edison Research on election night. As with his other research, patterns began to emerge.
Every state had, in my mind, too many of these instances of vote counts going down instead of up. Here you can see the prime offenders. Actually, all 50 states are included here, plus the District of Columbia. In four states, there are a high number of instances of the vote count going down. Those four states are North Carolina, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Georgia. Pennsylvania and Georgia are the highest in terms of how many times it happened. North Carolina, well, you'll see in a moment. So let's look at those four states in county level detail. In all these cases, any of the counties that are colored in, usually in yellow, had, in my mind, way too many instances of votes going down during the night. Let's look at Georgia, and you'll see that only one county did not have too many of those instances. Let's look at Pennsylvania, kind of seeing the same thing there. Now let's have a look at North Carolina. Yes, you are seeing correctly. I judge every single county in North Carolina to have too many instances of the vote counts going down. The last one I want to look at is Michigan. Michigan had two counties, Eaton and Macon, which had an incredible number of these events. However, it had a lot of other counties, and I've noted those in orange, that definitely had too many, far less than the two counties I mentioned, but still way too many. Now, these are four battleground counties in 2020. I find it interesting and a bit suspicious that these four states had the largest incidence of vote counts going down. So let's look at a summary of the data. And you can see that it is not a small problem. I find it interesting that when the various third-party companies that could have had a hand in the 2020 election fraud are discussed, Edison Research rarely comes up. But it looks to me like Edison almost had to have foreknowledge of what was going on and might have actually been part of the control mechanism. I say that because you can see in so many counties, the election day and absentee votes showing that pattern of a controller that is trying to find a solution. Why is it trying to find a solution there at Edison? Well, Edison is the only place that every single vote passes through in an election.
2020 is not the only election which shows problems with the Edison data. In the 2022 Colorado Republican primary, Tina Peters was facing off against Pam Anderson and Mike O'Donnell for Colorado Secretary of State. Garfield County completed their counting and closed their election office at about 10:30 p.m. on election night. At that time, the Edison reporting showed Anderson with a big lead, followed by Peters and O'Donnell. At 11:30 p.m., an update to the reporting switched the votes of all three candidates, showing Peters with the big lead and Anderson in last. This remained the current totals until the next afternoon, when a new update switched them back. It must be wondered why an update occurred an hour after the county completed its counting, and what this might mean. Throughout the country, primary candidates who aligned with Donald Trump found their results drastically underperformed their pre-election polling. The most shocking and unexplained anomaly in the election night reporting is the existence of what has been called the Edison Zero. During the morning hours of November 4th, every state's counts have a zero vote record at some point.
Now, I didn't discover the Edison Zero. I want to be clear on that. When I got into this thing, it was being discussed in many circles. But I'm not sure there's anyone who obsessed over it as much as I did. Tucked away in the Edison election night reporting files was something that has come to be known as the Edison Zero. Every state had one point during the morning of November 4th, 2020, when, according to the Edison records, their vote count dropped to zero. All 50 states at different points during the night had this happen to them. For some, a couple, it came back after a second. Some, it took 6 days before there was an update in the Edison files which restored their votes. And when they came back, by the way, it looked like a different election, because that is where Biden started to come back from Donald Trump's lead that had existed up until that point. Here you can see the timeline of the night, and the blue bars are the vote counts, just the raw vote counts for the presidential race in these states. And you will see that one by one, they all go back to zero for a while. Some of them haven't come back by the time this chart is finished. Now, I do find it interesting, I keep using that word, that this began happening just a short time after Florida was called for President Trump. So the theory goes that with Florida gone, Georgia now became a must-win. Pennsylvania became a must-win. Michigan became a must-win. Wisconsin became a must-win. And, history shows what happened in those states. I mentioned in an earlier chapter about the F curves in Wisconsin and Michigan. And my theory on that is that they did not have enough runway in the terms of the voter rolls and absentee ballots to make up the ground they needed to make up. So they had to go back to the old ways that I mentioned a long time ago in this movie. And they just had to start rolling the trucks and printing the ballots.
Edison Research did not reply to requests for an explanation of what you have just seen. As a private sector company, Edison is not bound by Freedom of Information Act laws even when working with government institutions.
A word about Seidel. Seidel is a European company that has an American division. They also own Clarity Elections, which handles the direct election night reporting for 9 states, at least they did in the 2020 election. Seidel America was undergoing a bankruptcy reorganization and appeared to be in very bad state during the 2020 election. However, I was able to talk to a gentleman who had obtained the election night reporting files from Seidel in Europe. We spent some time comparing them, and we found that they were identical to the Edison files, except the Seidel files had cut off at a time period a few days before the Edison files. So how is Edison Research sharing data with Seidel Europe? I think that's a valid question to ask. Edison Research has employees on staff, high-level employees, who have experience writing election modeling software. Is it too much of a stretch to theorize that Edison may have been involved in the production of the algorithm that stole the 2020 election? I don't like throwing accusations around, but the questions about the election night reporting with Edison Research are so deep and so wide that it makes me wonder why these questions aren't being asked at a very high level. The news organizations like the New York Times are making it a lot harder to find the Edison data during the elections these days. I wonder why that is.
Around 500 BC, the Greeks devised what may have been the first system of voting. Each year, land owners would cast votes on broken pieces of pottery. Instead of voting in favor of candidates, the Greeks were voting for any political leader they wished to be exiled from the country for 10 years. If any politician received more than 6,000 votes, they were exiled. This system ensured that only extremely unpopular or corrupt leaders would be removed.
Fun fact, these little broken pieces of pottery were called in Greek ostraca, which is where we get our English word for ostracize, a concept that I've become very familiar with over the last few years.
Throughout history, the concept and methods of voting evolved in countries experimenting with democracy. At odds were always the good men who wanted the citizens to have a say in who led them, and corrupt men who wanted to be sure they could control that process. America's founding fathers outlined a system whereby the people would vote for a local representative who would look after the district's interests for a few years. This House of Representatives was an elected version of the British House of Commons. They gave the state legislators the duty of selecting 2 senators who would look after the interests of their state. The Senate thus became our version of the British House of Lords. These senators could not be removed or replaced directly by the people, but by their choice of their legislators. Knitting together what they felt were the best parts of British, Greek, and other systems, they created America as a constitutional republic. The success of that republic depended upon the honor of their elected representatives, and the citizens' ability to remove dishonorable men, and later women, from their posts. Over the next 213 years, America voted in pretty much the same way. Ballots would be marked by hand, and then also counted by hand. Our elections evolved as more groups were enfranchised. In 1913, partially due to the efforts of publisher William Randolph Hearst, the 17th Amendment created direct election of senators by the state's voters. This change eliminated deadlocks in the legislatures, which sometimes delayed the filling of open Senate seats, and eliminated the possibility of bribing the legislators. But some believe that it went too far, drastically altering the priorities of the senators from being accountable to their state, to being beholden to their national party in order to get re-elected. All along, powerful men tried their best to subvert the elections, and our history is full of examples. Boss Tweed's Tammany Hall controlled most of New York's elections in the late 1860s. In 1946, veterans from McMinn County, Tennessee returned from World War II to find that their elections were being subverted, and was leading to the fraudulent election of the county sheriff. After their demands to inspect the ballots were denied, the veterans committed an armed attack and siege on the election office to obtain the real ballots, which was successful and proved that the election had been defrauded. Instead of being jailed, veteran Bill White, the leader of the attack, was named a deputy sheriff. Although not usually with guns, Americans have fought hard for their right to vote, and the right to have their vote counted. As we approach the new century and millennium, things began to change.
As we approach the new millennium, there was a lot of experimentation going on how we could potentially vote quicker and more reliably. There was rumblings at this point. There were some machines, computers were starting to be used. There was a system in Florida in which punch cards were used, in which little holes called chads would be punched out to indicate the voter's choice. This led to the whole 2000 presidential election debacle between Bush and Gore, where it came down to decisions as to if a chad was only partially pushed out, would it count, or did it have to be pushed out the whole way? It was a huge mess, and that single case really did a lot to destroy people's confidence in the way they were voting. This was the perfect opportunity for companies who were beginning to market computerized systems. Back then, companies like Diebold and Sequoia, to basically convince the public that humans had forgotten how to count. So we needed computers to do it for us. So during the 2000s, then, we had the Smartmatics and Sequoias and then Dominions, all sharing employees moving back and forth, all sharing common code bases. And that is a direct line to how we got where we are now.
Jeff has had personal contact with whistleblowers from both Smartmatic and Dominion, and seen their evidence of the cross-pollination between most of the election software vendors. They will tell their stories as soon as it is safe for them to do so.
Now, the current election system vendors will vehemently deny that there is any kind of common code base, any kind of cooperation ever between they and the other companies. The facts do not support that. In fact, they support the exact opposite.
Computer systems are, by their very nature, difficult to protect from outside internet intrusion. Just in the past year, we have seen many crippling attacks on government and private sector entities. Any system connected to the internet through cable, Wi-Fi, or cellular modem is susceptible, and both the number of attacks and the damage caused continues to grow. The claim of the vendors providing computerized election management systems to our counties is that they are air-gapped, meaning that they do not have any possible connection to the internet. Despite these assurances, evidence is continually being found of election systems which are indeed connected to the global networks. Jeff's investigations came across a 2021 affidavit from a Serbian national with ties to Dominion. This affidavit is in the possession of our government, but to anyone's knowledge, it has never been followed up on. The recent leak of Dominion emails, proving their strong ties to Serbia, provides context to this affidavit. The question is, why is software written in a foreign country, with a history of corruption, permitted to be used in our elections, which have been named part of our nation's critical infrastructure?
The person who has the access codes can gain access and do anything he wants. Serbian software engineers who made the software know everything. They did this for money, or following someone's orders. In lawsuits, there are expertise that prove that the software was programmed at the beginning to add votes to Biden. The first person in the whole world who published this fact is a friend of mine. Furthermore, it is indisputable that the counting of votes was stopped in the election night. It is also indisputable that the voting machines were connected to the internet. In August 2016, Hunter Biden was in Belgrade incognito, during his father's official visit to Serbia. This is when he visited Dominion headquarters at the address Osman Dikic Street No. 18, where both the headquarters of the branch and the representation were located. The proof of this claim is located in his laptop, which is currently in the possession of the FBI. Key persons for resolving the issue of election fraud in the US are Goran Obradovic, Bojan Djordjevic and Ranko Stamatovic, because they are the directors of Dominion companies in Serbia, and they definitely met Hunter Biden during his visit to Dominion in Belgrade.
The question is, why is software written in a foreign country, with a history of corruption, permitted to be used in our elections, which have been named part of our nation's critical infrastructure? Would the Department of Defense allow defense contractors to have missile parts assembled in Serbia by Serbian nationals?
I'd like to show you something to demonstrate how difficult it is to keep our election systems from being accessed by external actors. I'm going to show you a typical election office. Now, not every election office is going to match this 100%, but most will follow this this general guideline. So you'll have an election management server, or EMS, that usually contains the databases that run the whole system and that keep the counts of the election. You will then have a router or switch, and that is simply a piece of hardware that connects everything together in the election network. You'll have a client, typically, whether it's a desktop computer or a laptop. That's the one the clerks use to actually run the election, do the different things they need to do, so they don't have to actually go and do it at the server itself. So there will be a client piece there. There's usually a scanner so that they can scan in ballots. And there's often a printer so that they can print things from there. There may be multiples of any of these, but we're taking the simple case here. Now, in order for this system to be truly air-gapped, that means that network just has to include those items and have no connection to the outside world. Even one wireless, Bluetooth, or cell modem component in any of these on the screen now would make it possible for intrusion to occur into the system, and also enable the system to contact the external internet as well. Now, how things are supposed to work, usually, is that there'll be a USB stick or USB flash drive that takes the results, and then they take it to the office, and they load that information into their own computer, which then is part of a network which has a router, switch, usually Wi-Fi, and printers and other devices. Now, this network is and has to be connected to the internet, because this is how they send election night reporting results. This is how they send
the certified results to the Secretary of State. All of these devices on the right-hand side here are also potential targets, because the results, which are loaded into the office computer, are then available over the internet to anybody who wants to get them. And in fact, the fact that they are transferred to the Secretary of State means that they can be intercepted and changed at that point. So there are other things that can exist in this office network. We have the Albert sensors. The Albert sensors were kindly provided by the government to detect intrusions. Now, I want to point out, if you note, the Albert sensor can only detect intrusions to the office network. If the internal EMS network is truly air-gapped, then the Albert sensor won't even be needed to try to detect any intrusions, because they will be impossible. So that is a misconception that some people have, that the Albert sensors are detecting intrusions at that level. They are detecting intrusions to systems which are and have to be on the internet. Then you have FirstNet, which was designed as an emergency communication system for first responders, which then got co-opted into being used to communicate between different election offices, polling places, what have you. These are two other points of attack. If an external entity wants to get an early look at results, or potentially do something to the office computers. And if it's sounding like I don't trust them, you would be correct, because nothing in the system, to my knowledge, is trustworthy. And that's why, frankly, it all has to go away. We need to go back to hand-counted ballots. And I'll be talking a lot about that in the next segment.
35 wireless devices were identified on the DVSD suite system, including the ImageCast Voter Activation ICVA computer ordered on August 16, 2015 by DVS for use in Mesa County. It was ordered by DVS, configured with a Dell Wireless 1560 internal wireless adapter, providing both 2.4 GHz and 5 GHz dual band Wi-Fi and Bluetooth connectivity to and through that ICVA computer. In total, Mesa County was provided 35 D-Suite components with wireless capability installed, Dell Latitude 7450 computers providing ICVA functionality with Dell Wireless 1560 modules, and Dell Optiplex 9030 ImageCast Central, ICC, systems with Dell wireless modules. A Dell E310 DW wireless printer was configured as the EMS server's default printer, bringing the total number of wireless devices to 36.
In the spring of 2022, I was invited to a meeting which had a lot of the cyber people, as it were, who were investigating the election. It was the first time I had the opportunity to meet a lot of these people, and it was one of the first times that I actually got a chance to meet Mike Lindell. And as we're all talking together, the subject of the 2021 symposium came up, and the what were called PCAP data, and how everyone there was, shall we say, not very enthusiastic about what had happened with that data. During the conversation, someone suggested that someone should actually go to the source of this data and see if they could perform some further validation on it. And Mike thought that was a good idea, and he asked for a volunteer. And I looked over, and my hand was in the air. And that's how I met Dennis Montgomery.
Dennis Montgomery has almost 50 years of high-level computer software and hardware design experience. After successfully developing numerous FDA-approved medical technologies, he began specializing in developing artificial intelligence technologies for various U.S. government intelligence agencies, including the CIA, NSA, DOD, DNI, DIA, Air Force, Homeland Security, and others. Specifically, Dennis developed and deployed systems for encryption, 3D modeling, object identification and tracking, surveillance, pattern matching, cybersecurity, and cyber warfare. In the mid-2000s, Dennis received a top-secret security clearance. He then designed a sophisticated system of digital surveillance to be used against America's enemies. This system became known as the Hammer, and was eventually moved to Fort Washington, Maryland, where it still exists today. During the Obama administration, Dennis found that his system was being used against citizens, corporations, and organizations within the United States. His attempts to become a government whistleblower were met by a campaign of character assassination and aggression by the government and the media. This battle continues to this day, despite a tremendous toll on Dennis's health and finances. During the 2020 election, Dennis was able to acquire data from a Hammer system which told him two things. First, that the system was being used heavily to monitor county and state election systems. Secondly, the data told him that entities apparently outside of the United States were attacking these systems, and in some cases, affecting the election results. Dennis shared this information with a trusted expert, who almost immediately leaked news of it to Mike Lindell and others. At this point, Dennis, who wanted nothing more than for the truth to be public, had a big problem.
Immediately, Dennis began receiving communication, oftentimes anonymous communication, but Dennis knew where it was coming from, reminding him of the terrible consequences should he release all of the data. And there is a lot that I can't say about this, but what I will say is that what Dennis Montgomery has goes far beyond PCAPs, packet captures on the network. It goes, frankly, far beyond our elections. There began a legal battle because, obviously, state secret protection was not intended to hide crimes by the government. That's why we have whistleblower laws, which unfortunately were not properly applied to Dennis. And the battle continues to this very day. Our Justice Department and our intelligence agencies are ignoring subpoenas. They are releasing conflicting information to different sources. It is a full court press to keep this information from reaching the light of day. And it may take a honest DOJ and new leadership in our intelligence agencies before that can happen. That's not stopping Dennis and Mike and others from still attempting to get them to drop that state secret privilege because of the extraordinary circumstances behind it. But there's no guarantee of when that's going to happen. That has been my single biggest disappointment of the last 3 years.
For the first time, Jeff can share some aggregated results from some of the data obtained by Dennis Montgomery. The aggregated data from 8 areas monitored by the Hammer during our 2020 and 2022 elections shows that there was a remarkable amount of traffic from China during the monitored periods. During the Gwinnett County, Georgia election in 2022, more than 1 in 5 packets of data recorded had an IP address which geolocates to China. 5 to 10% is the typical range Jeff observed. The Department of Defense also had a keen interest in our elections. Here you can see the added percent of traffic from systems within the DoD. Jeff discovered something else very interesting when evaluating the data. While it was not uncommon for a Chinese IP address to appear in several county data feeds, there was one, and only one, IP address which appeared in all of them. According to Melissa Data, this IP address is located in Xi'an, China. While computer systems from China can, and do, regularly catalog American online systems, the sheer amount of accesses found in the Hammer data is far beyond what we would expect to see for this purpose.
I do need to point out something that is very important when looking at this data. Hackers can make IPs look like they come from anywhere. It is possible that someone purchased a huge army of botnets in China. Not saying that's what happened, but it is a possibility that has to be considered. When I first saw the graphs, when I was watching one of Mike Lindell's movies that showed these intrusions all coming from China, my first reaction back then was, wow, somebody really wants to start a war between America and China. Now, they could have come from China, but it's important that we temper our enthusiasm. It is possible to trace any of these to figure out if they were actual Chinese actors or, again, if they were someone who wanted us to think that they were Chinese actors. The problem is that the only entity with the resources to do that sort of tracking is a government. And our government has, of course, no interest right now in pursuing that particular line of inquiry. Let me summarize everything by just saying that everything you've seen is really the tip of the iceberg. Again, these are things that I have personally seen, that I've researched, or that have come from extremely trusted sources. Our use of computerized election systems is a clear and present danger. And it's a danger that we ignore at our extreme peril.